Okay.
We're discussing members of what the Warren Commission or the CIA called the White Russian Community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, who provided the descriptions of the character of Lee Harvey Oswald.
They were the painters in the whole tableau. They came forward with information about him that was fed to them by other people or they created, and they had a role to give this image. And Alan Dulles, at the very beginning of the Warren Commission, said, I'll collect all the evidence of the motive and that there's a pattern of assassins. And they're going to fit Lee Harvey Oswald into a preconceived pattern by using witnesses to say he was such and such a person when the evidence doesn't back up this to be true. And I just read off the list of people. Now, the important thing about...
Well, the one item alone that said he was never able to hold a job except for very short periods of time. He was working for the federal government right up till the time he was killed himself, wasn't he?
Well, he was working. He was in the Marines for 3 years with never an altercation or anything that you could say. There was one minor argument with an officer, and he threw some coffee on him because he thought he was smarter than that particular man, and he thought the Marine Corps was run by a bunch of idiots. You know, he was very arrogant because he was very bright, and he thought they were very stupid. And they had a problem there, but it was a minor thing. And they said he rejected authority. There was an article that came out last week on the new head of the Marine Corps, and he bragged about it's the stiffest, roughest, toughest group of bunch that ever get together, and that we don't compromise our standards. You have to go through this training. Well, Oswald enlisted when he was 16. They turned him down because he was too young. And it was special permission and mother's signature. He got in at 17. And he loved every minute of it. So it wasn't that rough and tough for him that he couldn't take the boot camp and the training. If you reject authority, you would simply crumble. If you were psychologically banged up like they claimed he was by the time he was 17, there's no way that he could go 3 years there. And then he not only leaves the Marine Corps, which is the most authoritarian segment of the whole United States framework, but he goes over to the Soviet Union, which is the most authoritarian framework of the entire world, probably. And if you don't shape up, you get out. And he masters the language, which is self-discipline, while he's in the Marine Corps, and so that when he arrives, you can't tell him from a native Russian, which is sheer discipline. You can't resent authority and master that kind of discipline. You would go the other way and drop out. You would really be sick and blow your top. But he masters the language and goes to work at a radio factory where he's never fired. They never complain. He sends a letter to the State Department, I'm ready to come home. He held a job in the Soviet Union, 40 below zero in Moscow, voluntarily. It was in Minsk, not resenting 5 years of the most intensive kind of discipline. 3 years in the Marines and two in the Soviet Union. You have to look at what a person is really doing, not what the government is saying happened. Because this is authoritarian regime for 5 years and no sign of cracking. He came home perfectly healthy and happy. There's one description here where he was rejected by society and American at home. I have a whole research I pulled out of the 26 volumes just on the return trip of Lee Harvey Oswald. He writes to the State Department and said, I'm ready to come home and don't prosecute me for anything I've done. And they assure him that they won't. He says, I'm bringing home a Russian wife, and the Department of Immigration in San Antonio said, no, she doesn't pass the requirements of certain tests. We haven't given her, you know, or questioned political affiliations. And a wire comes from the embassy in Moscow. Send him home immediately. It's in the best interest of the United States. Don't ask any questions. All waivers were passed for Lee Harvey Oswald. He was taken to Russia where he was given a special suite. Marina Oswald testified that everyone in the hotel knew them. There was a movie going on, a movie convention or people, a cinema festival or something, and the hotel was filled with celebrities. But they got a room, she said, because everyone knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And they were taken to Brussels and to a boat. And when he arrived in New York, he was met by an agency and taken to the hotel in a limousine, taken to the State Department offices and given a phone, you know, to call his brother in Texas and arrange the money to go there, driven from with a limousine to the airport. No public
VIP treatment.
No public vehicles at all. The arrival home is a chapter I want to do on the red carpet treatment when he arrived in Russia, when he arrived home. And he not only arrives home, but the first person he calls is Max Clark, who's chief of Convair, one of the names I mentioned here, of security for Convair Aircraft, former FBI. And the members of the White Russian community describe Galley Clark, Max Clark's wife as being of the cabin and lodges of the Soviet regime. She was a princess in Europe, very wealthy Russian exile who was brought up in France in a very prominent family. And when Marina Oswald stayed at a home of Elena Hall, it was Golly Clark who was bringing her groceries, checking in on her. This very aristocratic lady was serving Marina Oswald. She was never called as a witness. Max Clark was, because he's in security. She sat in the same room when the Warren Commission called her husband, and she was never asked a question about what she had in common with Marina Oswald. So I have the people that created the image of Lee Oswald, and then I broke down, and this takes time, believe me, the volume number in which they testify and the amount of pages they give that the Warren Commission questions them. George de Morangil gave 118 pages of testimony, more than any single witness in the Warren Report. And Lydia Dmytryk, whose information is locked up in the National Archives for 75 years, is hardly asked a question. She was very nervous when she was called in. She was given 12 pages of questioning, yet in Lee Harvey Oswald's diary, he has her name at the Hotel Berlin in Moscow when he was in the Soviet Union. And this woman takes the stand and is asked nothing about the information that Lee Harvey Oswald could have met her in the Soviet Union. And she's very nervous, and her husband was never called as a witness. And I know that he and Lydia are a counterpart agent and wife team, like the DeMorangils or Lee and Marina. So Lydia Dmytryk was given 12 pages of questioning, and I broke down the volume number and the page number that they were questioned and the date that they were called, because this was important. How many people, you could squeeze in 8 of these people in one day, and they were to create the entire motive for the Warren Report. And then I wrote down which lawyers interviewed them, because I found that there were discrepancies in what these people were saying. And Mr. Jenner of the Warren Commission interviewed George de Morangil in April, and he got one story about what happened. Then Mr. Liebler interviews Everett Glover, and he has an entirely different account of what happened, but nobody cross-examines. Now, one of the important things I wrote down is that when each witness was called, members of the Warren Commissioner's staff who were present were in the room. And of the whole list of names that I read, there are 30 people. The Warren Commission attended the hearings of 3 of these people. They went to hear Mr. Gregory, and they should have, because along with Max Clark, Peter Gregory it was a toss-up whether Oswald called Peter Gregory first or Max Clark when he arrived in the Fort Worth area. It was within minutes that he reached each of them. And then he went to Mr. Gregory's office. He's an engineer for a big company there, and brought him a document that a secretary had typed up and thought Oswald was an agent of the CIA. She said it's for an engineer, he told her when she typed it up. And because of the information on Russia, she assumed that he was an agent of the government. And then he goes to see a man in the Fort Worth area named Gregory, who is an engineer, and brings a document to him. So that's Mr. Gregory. And the minute that Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, the man who was to be with Marina Oswald and place her in charge of the Secret Service was Mr. Gregory. He took her to the Inner Six Flags and took her then to the Secret Service place, where she was immediately to meet with persons high up in government in Nixon's administration, like Isaac Don Levine and other channels where money was to come to Marina. Mr. Gregory was the first man that Oswald met, along with Max Clark, and he also was with Marina Oswald immediately. And the testimony of Marguerite Oswald before the Warren Commission says Gregory is involved in this. I know he's involved, just seeing with Marina after the assassination. You know, she knew that Gregory was involved. And so Peter Gregory was the gentleman that Lee saw when he arrived. Never cross-examined, but members of the commission heard his testimony. And they also heard the testimony of Catherine Ford. And that was important, because it was at the home of Mrs. Ford that Isaac Don Levine was to contact Marina Oswald. And that's the same Isaac Don Levine who was the man who worked with Whitaker Chambers in framing Alger Hiss. It's the same person. He's important to Richard Nixon's life and his campaign and to the covert government which exists. He was with Marina Oswald, and she was staying at the home of Catherine Ford. The Warren Commission heard the testimony of Michael Payne. They sat there while Michael Payne talked. He was the host of Lee Harvey Oswald. I've mentioned him before, third generation Harvard. His parents, father, grandfather graduated from Harvard. Michael left there 1 year before graduation but continued advanced studies. He's a nuclear physicist, a designer for helicopters at Bell Helicopter. The vice president and manager of Bell Helicopter is General Dornberger, the Nazi general that came over with von Braun in the space agency group that was brought over from Nazi Germany. That was the host of Lee Harvey Oswald. And the Warren Commission heard the testimony of Michael Payne. But no one was present when Max Clark talked from the commission. Or Mrs. Clark wasn't even called and she sat in the room. No one from the commission heard Lydia Dimitri. Dr. Alfred Goldberg, the historian sent from the Pentagon, heard George de Morenschild, the only link of Lee Harvey Oswald to any kind of association with a rifle, and who was responsible for introducing him to the Paynes, who made the connection to the book depository that where he would be moving boxes, supposedly. No member of the Warren Commission attended that hearing at all. Nobody heard Everett Glover's testimony. He is a friend of the far right wing, and the people that were later to link to the motorcade, he knows he's politically far right wing, and Everett Glover, it was at his home that Marina Oswald and Lee Oswald attended and met Michael and Ruth Payne. Dorothy Gravitas, nobody heard her testimony. Charles Gregory, no one from the commission was there. The Halls, nobody was present. Mr. and Mrs. Charles Harris and Ed Harris gave affidavits damaging Lee and Marina Oswald. They were never called to testify, and no one re-examined or cross-filed their evidence to document, to say it was true. Alex Kleiner was never called as a witness, but his affidavits run straight through the Warren Commission report, creating the motive of Lee Harvey Oswald. Ilya Mamontov never met Lee Oswald. He gives the communist bit, trained in Minsk at the School for Assassins, and breaks down. He's in the third stage of the most violent revolution that he was sent here. You know, it's completely Lee Harvey Oswald's associations, you see, Mamontov. And when you ask him, well, did you know him? He said, heavens, no. But my mother-in-law, Mrs. Gravitas, used to speak to Marina Oswald on the telephone. And Marina was feeding them all this information, you see, and working with that branch. I have what I call a Dallas family tree. I'm going into this in great depth in case anybody...
Yeah, this is what I wanted to point out. Is,
yes.
Very few people have done such detailed research as you have done, and I've seen the family tree that you've drawn up. You've taken each one of these individuals as to when did he meet Marina, when did he meet Lee Harvey
Oswald,
who introduced them.
How many times they saw them.
And then you take the person who introduced them and tracked them down and found out who they were and everything, and found all these interrelations, and it's very complex and very complicated. But what strikes me is few people have done like 8 or 9 years of intensive research of the kind that you've done, but everyone that I've been aware of who has done any research, you know, and they're kind of categorized as assassination buffs or conspiracy nuts or something like that.
The crazies, yeah.
Every single one of them comes up with just really radical inconsistencies and contradictions in the Warren Commission report that were never challenged.
No.
No cross-examinations, witnesses giving conflicting testimony and this kind of thing, and very damaging evidence being given that was just kind of bypassed. People who might have had testimony to give who were never called.
Well, see, what I've cross-filed is one of the books I want to write is Witnesses Not Called, like Mrs. Clark is an example, Mr. Dimitri. Then you can do witnesses called that weren't asked the right questions. You see, I've really torn this thing down into the nitty-gritty.
At the beginning of our program, when we were talking about the signature overlays and the handwriting machines
I've
and all that,
yeah.
We began with an assumption that everybody listening had been reading the newspaper articles and knew what we were talking about, and that's probably a dangerous assumption to make. Because not only do few people do 8 or 9 years intensive research such as you've done, few people even read their newspapers, and when they do read their newspapers, they don't know what they're reading. They don't know that this sort of thing ties in together, and when they see talk about the handwriting machine or the signature overlays and all that, they don't flash on, hey, this is the same operation that was utilized in the Lee Harvey Oswald ordering the gun and all this sort of thing.
That's right.
It's really... A little frustrating to me, and I imagine very frustrating to you and to anyone else who has devoted a great segment of their life to doing this kind of research and trying to get this information across to people. And like this past program, this past 45 minutes that we spent, you're rattling off names that are very familiar to you.
I feel like they're members of my family. I used to call them my family for a while. I've made a point of studying them. Because, you see, the problem, I think, is this. If you think that your government is big and vast or that you're ignorant and they're wise, you get yourself into a warfare state. And I'm no more intelligent than any other person, but I do have a certain moral value. I think I see a murder or a crime, and I know it's wrong, and I've stayed with it. And that's a quality you can develop, too. I was called yesterday, a teacher.
This is what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
The point that you're making is that our government was overthrown.
In 1963.
And that we have a covert government that is running this country right now, and a very dangerous and an insidious kind of conspiracy that is practically running the world.
That can be proven and documented. See, that is the important thing, is that it can be documented, and that we're trying to get across to the people out there a way to stop it. Now, a subject came up this week. You had a broadcast during the week when President Nixon gave his peace plan for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the news department here, Phil Kogan, called and asked several people in the community to give their opinion of that speech. Donald Schmay, and representing the Republican Party here, and a member from the prisoner of war group.
Yes.
And then Phil called me, and he asked me, would I listen to the president's peace proposal, and then if he telephoned, give an analysis. Well, I listen with a set of ears that I've sharpened, because I know that every word matters. When you read Mein Kampf, every word that Hitler said mattered. And all you had to do is read it. If you pass it off, you're in trouble. So I listened very carefully to what he said. And when I was asked to give my opinion on the telephone, I brought out that the only new thing in the peace proposal was the fact that Thieu offered to resign. And that stepped down 1 month before the election, which he hadn't done before, which admitted that it was a rigged election. And I called attention to the fact this was the election that Ronald Reagan said was made through like George Washington. And I cut out an article of the paper this week of a man analyzing Nixon's speech and saying the only new wrinkle was the Thieu resignation. And he referred to it as a total ploy. And it goes into our election in 1972. And I tie it in together now as we said we'd mention alternatives or things for people to do. And I bring in this thing. I commented to Phil and on KLRB that if Richard Nixon is sincere on letting those people select their candidate to run the government in South Vietnam, then he should step down from office before the nominations in 1972 in San Diego. And he should allow all the researchers to examine what's locked up in the National Archives. There's documents, a suit against Mr. Kaiser in Los Angeles for having access to the evidence of the Sirhan murder, the alleged murder of Robert Kennedy, and there are many people that believe Sirhan didn't fire the fatal bullets. Robert Kaiser has access to information by his own admission that the Los Angeles Police Department and FBI have never had. And you have to say, if this isn't a clandestine government, what reason?
Yeah, if you just read what is on public record without going into any locked up archives or secret documents or anything, there is certainly enough to give you a strong suspicion that a lot more happened at the Ambassador Hotel
than we're going to be told. In fact, next week.
As a matter of fact, wasn't there one person who claimed to be a witness to having seen somebody else fire a bullet into Robert Kennedy's head?
Well, that is the man Donald Shulman saw a guard, Thane Caesar, pull a gun, shoot it. He's named the man, the weapon, his occupation. He comes from Lockheed, aerospace industry again. He's a member of the Wallace Party. Los Angeles Times, which is a branch of this covert government, that and the St. Louis Globe-Dispatch, had in their magazine section this last Sunday, a three-page article by Robert Kaiser defending his book, RFK Must Die, in which he calls the assassination buffs crazy and mismanaged sleuths that we're off. We may as well collect butterfly wings. This is what he's saying. And next week, I keep making promises for next week, you know, because we have so much material. I'm going to go into depth and show you where Robert Kaiser comes from and where men like Dr. Albert Alice and Kaiser, who hires them, what they come from. And he's talking about, used to work with Braden's campaign in California. That was financed by the CIA. That came out just a year or two ago, the Tom Brady's whole outfit was financed by the CIA.
Yeah, well, if people like you are just a bunch of harmless nuts who are collecting butterfly wings, why this massive effort to discredit you?
Well, what I think we should do, and stop the name-calling, if Richard Nixon, getting back to that and political assassinations, in factual evidence, there's a lawsuit against the National Archives to open up the truth on the assassination to kill Robert Kennedy. And there's been a law that the autopsy and everything's blocked up for 75 years. If Richard Nixon is sincere about wanting a government that has a fair election in Vietnam, he should call a moratorium now and stop all of the locking up of evidence of these conspiracies. Now, last week there was an article that the government is spending between $60 and $80 million in the National Archives for top secret papers. To keep papers secret costs $80 million a year. And I am not paying my taxes this year, and I can tell the Internal Revenue right now, and I'll tell them then, that attached to my tax application, I'm putting the list of the lawsuits against the National Archives, on the one hand, of a right to access to the Truth of Freedom Information Act, to know who runs my government before I pay my taxes, and I'm attaching a copy of the article that it's costing $80 million to lock up what I spend night and day researching for 8 years, and then I'm attaching a list of government waste, military bungling of weapons never used that I've kept in an envelope through the past year. Just every article of something that is a total military waste, such as that tower for $63 million in the new budget down in Texas. It's an air tower 23 miles wide to tell us if there's life on the next planet. And I'm not going to pay the taxes on that $63 million tower in the Southwest, but I'm not going to pay it because the government locks up the information that would tell us how Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson became president. And people out there, if you don't want to pay your taxes because of Vietnam, take another issue, because the truth of Vietnam is locked up in these political assassinations. And just refuse to pay your taxes if you want copies of the lawsuit, right, and I'll have the mimeographer sent out to you and say, we want to know why, when everything is out and the researchers have examined all of that, and we know there's no conspiracy, then we'll pay our taxes, because then it's a legitimate government and represents the will of the people.
Well, anything that might be bugging people, unemployment, high taxes, inflation, the war in Vietnam,
the removal of methadone treatment, anything. It's
the government's seeming indifference or inability to cope with ecological problems. All of these things tie in to government action or inaction. And in order to get any kind of action, you have to first... it was like Mort Saul once said. He said, people keep telling me, you know, you're trying to destroy the government. You're trying to destroy the government. He says, I'm not trying to destroy the government. I'm just trying to find it.
You're just trying to... you know, some woman called me who had typed up some of my notes after one of the shows here I wanted to send to somebody. And she called me the next week and said, would you talk about that bill along the coast at the shore, you know, isn't going to be protected. It was just defeated. I said, this is dialogue assassination, and I talk about political assassinations because... when you get a clandestine government in that is overthrown, it never represents the will of the people. And I will go on every week and talk about documents and evidence to prove the government was overthrown. Then you'll get your coastline back because people that care won't destroy your coast.
This is what I wanted to get across, is this whole thing about tying all this in together and interrelating everything to assassination. This is not a morbid obsession on the part of Mae Brussel. It's because this... matters very deeply,
and it links the
to everything that's happening today.
That's right. The documentation I have, like in 1 hour, I try to share the minutes of the meeting, how they talk about. I'll bring you a book in December. You'll see a pattern running through. In 1972, another book comes out. There's a pattern between Manson and Sirhan Ray. I've talked about Manson. He was part of the political thing. Then this author goes in and throws in the shooting of Garfield. I read the whole biography of Gatteau and the shooting of Garfield to see how a presidential assassination by a loner does fit a picture, or is there a pattern? And the whole life of Gatteau is entirely different.
These things are becoming more and more blatant, though, you know, like the assassination of George Jackson was handled so poorly. Attica was handled so poorly, where obvious lies made the front pages, made the evening news on television, and Mother and Father America sat there, and I don't care how disinterested, how ignorant anybody might be, everybody picked up on this because, you know, it was just so blatant and so obvious. So they're even getting sloppy in their cover-ups because they...
When you have that much power...
They have no respect for the public, you know, and then they say, we can get away with anything. Nobody's going to oppose us now.
That's right. They've gotten to the point where, well, nobody is questioning, and this is why we go on every week, is to wake up.
Kent State, if you're concerned about Kent State, that all figures into
this. Well, the most flagrant thing about the Kent State was having a picture in the newspaper calling the media and showing the secretary burn the minutes of the grand jury hearing in front of you.
Yeah.
I saved that photograph because this is just telling you where it's at. We even talked about it on one of the shows.
The evidence in the Robert Kennedy case, vital, vital evidence in a major national assassination being mislaid or misplaced, and other evidence being lost because it didn't fit the picture that they wanted to create.
Well, Robert Kaiser says in his article, he was a newspaper
James
man.
James Earl Ray never coming to trial.
He says there's a conspiracy, doesn't come to trial. Robert Kaiser said if Robert Kennedy were alive, he would be the president. I think we really have to know what happened there before we have our next election. I'm working so hard, and I hope some of you people who keep listening will write to your public official and say, I heard Mae Brussel on KLRB radio, and that I want the evidence made available to her and other serious researchers like the Committee to Investigate Assassination to find out if the government in power today is legitimate. We wonder what happened in Los Angeles. And that's all we want. I will shut up when they produce it. But as long as they lock it up, and all the documents and the contacts that CERN had and the evidence
Do you think,
of the conspiracy,
though, May, that if they did unlock it, at the point things are now, that's what I was bringing out, they are so blatant and so disrespectful of public opinion anyway, that if the evidence came out and you could prove absolutely that everything you say is true, do you think the general public at large, all across this great land of ours, would rise up and do anything?
If the public could get informed, you see, when a man like...
Would they, if somebody like Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew would stand up and say, all of this means nothing, be at ease, relax, it means nothing.
Well,
I think 75% of this country would say, oh, everything's okay.
No, they said the war is being conducted because there's communism in Southeast Asia, and we're being snowed under, the North Vietnamese are coming south, and there were enough people in this country who left the country, who refuse induction, who march around, who get themselves dossiers, to call attention at least to the war. The war
the
can't go
majority,
on forever now.
The great majority, though, the great silent majority or the great vocal majority, condemn these people.
But they're beginning to dislike the war. The point is, if you're right, you're never going to be accepted easily because you're throwing over a whole value system. It takes time. But the majority of the people in America, the majority, don't want the war anymore.
Well, now, the people listening to us right now, I wonder how they categorize themselves. Maybe they've turned this program off long ago because we're not playing any music. But the ones who have stuck with us, now, they obviously are concerned because they've been listening to this program for the better part of an hour now, and maybe they've been listening to all of your programs since you first came on the air. What can they personally do to better inform themselves, or if they're already convinced that what you're saying is true, what can they do about it?
What can they do? They can write, say, Mr. McGovern is a very popular man with the young people today, and you have mostly a young audience. We've ruled out McCloskey. He wouldn't touch the Warren Report. Mr. Comanche is going through the area running as a Democrat. Mr. Talcott will be running for office. You write to those people and keep copies of your letter, carbon copies, and then get them to me. Mail me a copy. Have it copied for 10 cents at the library. And write to them and say, Mae Brussel says that the elections are coming up in 1972 for President of the United States, and the evidence of the past election, the nomination of Senator Kennedy, is suppressed. Will you please have President Nixon open it up to prove that the election was a fair one before we get into the next election?
Yeah, this coming election will be meaningless unless this whole thing is cleared up, and time is running out, people. I really believe this.
Well, see, Lyndon Johnson went on the air that we should have a one-term president so he doesn't have to count to the people. Imagine if Richard Nixon has four more years. Every week I scare you and say, remember, Mae Brussel told you. But what's going to come down in 1972 is going to be heavy. And I think, pertaining to dialogue assassination, the one thing I emphasize is write to your public officials that you respect. Start with anyone you like out there. And say, will you please examine the documents and allow various researchers who have done 8 years or more on the political assassinations to have access to any information on any of these murders, on James Ray, Martin Luther King, that have a feast, a smorgasbord, lay it all out.
This has to be the first goal, is to get the archives opened up and the evidence
pertaining to 1972 election. We have to find out about the L.A. Police Department, because you see, in that department was contrived the political murder of the Sharon Tate thing. Manson wasn't in those homes. It was called the Manson thing. Charles Watson from Texas was the boy who did the stabbings. And we want to know about the Sirhan case and the Watson case, because the Attorney General in this state, Evel Younger, and Robert Houghton, Chief of Justice in the state, and Davis in Los Angeles, the Chief of Police, the whole team were named in a defendant of a suit for hiding information on these conspiracies, on the murder of Robert Kennedy specifically, in which it says the people have access to the information and the government agencies cannot decide what is good for us to know.
Well, the information that is public already, a matter of public record, certainly leads to strong suspicions that there's a lot more to all of these murders than we've been led to believe.
And it affects the Angela Davis trial, the Soledad Brothers, who runs the justice of the state of California, and how it's linked to John Mitchell and Richard Nixon.
So the goal is to get the archives opened up and this evidence made public. And anything that you can do toward that goal is a very positive act, and we can leave this on a positive note. We're all out of time, May, but
okay,
I do want to get that point across, that any letters they can write, any action that anybody can take to
and
get the archives
to the Robert
open,
Kennedy,
that's the first step.
That's right.
That's
you
the first
step.
Start
with that one.
Right. And once again, thank you, Mae Russell.